Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Into the Killing. For this case, we're going back to the summer of 1974. In July of that year, Richard Nixon was president, but his days in office were numbered after the Watergate scandal the year before. He was nearing impeachment. Instead of being impeached, he would resign from office on August 9th, making him the only American president to resign. Depending on what radio station you turned on in early July 1974, you might hear Benny and the Jets by Elton John, Band on the Run by Paul McCartney and Wings, or The Streak by Ray Stevens. They had all reached number one on the Billboard charts weeks earlier. Prairie Village is a small town in Kansas, and it's part of the Kansas City metropolitan area. In 1974, it had a population of about 26,000 people. It was home to the Wilson family. Alfred and Kay Wilson had one daughter and three sons. 13-year-old Elizabeth was their eldest. Then there was 11-year-old John, 5-year-old Alex, and 2-year-old Joseph. July 7th, 1974 was a hot day in Prairie Village. That evening, 11-year-old John and 13-year-old Elizabeth were doing what many kids do on hot days. They were at the public swimming pool. The pool was about 4 blocks from their home, and it was beside a high school. At some point, John did a cannonball into the water. He accidentally hit his sister, Elizabeth, when he jumped. As injured siblings tend to do, Elizabeth announced that she was going home to tell their mother and father. She told John he was going to be in big trouble when he got home. At about 7:15 p.m., John got out of the pool and he went to the parking lot. Elizabeth was in the parking lot and she yelled out to him and he saw her running in his direction. He decided to run away from her and hide behind the high school. To get from the pool to their home, they had to walk past the high school. John planned on jumping out and scaring her. But his sister never made it to the area where he was hiding. He waited for a while, then he set off for home by himself. Elizabeth was not home when he got there. The rule at the Wilson home was that by sundown, the children had to be in the yard. As the sun was setting, 13-year-old Elizabeth Wilson was nowhere to be found. At 10 p.m., her parents called the police. The police conducted a door-to-door search, but no one had seen Elizabeth. The next day, 250 members of the family's church helped search for Elizabeth. The FBI was eventually called in to help with the search. At all times, 100 agents were involved in the investigation. The problem was that the investigators had no evidence to work with. There were no witnesses or physical clues. No one saw any suspicious people or cars in the area. What they knew was that somewhere around the high school, Elizabeth disappeared. For all the investigators knew, she vanished through a hole in reality and ended up in another dimension. But the investigators held out hope that they could come up with a non-Twilight Zone answer as to what happened to 13-year-old Elizabeth Wilson. Since it was the summer, there was only one employee at the high school when she disappeared. It was a 27-year-old custodian named John Henry Horton. The police checked Horton's time card, and he had clocked out at about 8 p.m. for a dinner break. What was odd was that he didn't return until almost 11 p.m. The police talked to the janitor who worked overnights and remembered when Horton returned. He noticed that Horton wasn't wearing a shirt. He had fresh scratches on his back and on his arms. The police asked Horton about his extended dinner break and the scratches. He said he had car trouble in the parking lot of a local grocery store. The investigators talked to the employees at the grocery store, and no one saw Horan or his car in the parking lot that night. The police got a warrant and searched Horan's car. In the trunk, they found several troubling items. This included a butcher knife, a canvas bag, and balls of chloroform and sulfuric acid. Horan had explanations for some of the items in his trunk. For example, he said that the knife was a gift for his wife, and he liked to get high off the chloroform. The police talked to a 15-year-old girl who was at the tennis courts beside the pool on the same night that Elizabeth went missing. She said in front of the high school, a man came up to her and told her he had been watering the trees. He said he needed someone to help him turn off the water because the tap was too high off the floor. He wanted her to stand on his shoulders and turn off the tap. The young woman thought that the request was weird, so she said no and walked away. The police strongly suspected that this man was John Horan. They looked in the school and noticed that the water tap was just 6 inches off the ground. They wondered if Horan used a similar ploy to get Lisbeth into the school. So while the police considered Horan a suspect, they had no direct evidence tying him to Lisbeth's disappearance. It wasn't long before Lisbeth's case went cold. Since Lisbeth had not been found, her family held out hope that she was still alive. Sadly, any sense of hope that the Wilson had was shattered on January 7, 1975. About 9 miles away from the high school, a construction worker was surveying a vacant lot. He found a human skull. He called the police and the field was searched. They found some more bones. Dental records revealed that was the skull of Elizabeth Wilson. Her skull was found 6 months to the day that she went missing. The police did not find any more evidence in the field. Also, because of the state of the remains and the lack of them, the medical examiner could not determine how Elizabeth died. After the remains were found, the police wanted to arrest John Horan for murder. But the district attorney refused to press charges because they pointed out that there was no physical evidence that proved he killed Elizabeth. So the case was shelved. 27 years later, in 2001, a detective with the Prairie Village Police Department was looking for files related to another case. He happened to see several photocopied reports from Elizabeth Wilson's file. Something about the case caused attention, so he decided to look into it. He teamed up with a cold case investigator with the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, also known as the KBI. One of the first things he did was look at John Horan's criminal record. 19 years after the murder, in 1993, Horan was arrested for peeping in the bedroom window of a teenage girl. So they thought he had a lifelong predilection for teenage girls. The detective went to the evidence room, and they still had the items that were taken from John Horan's trunk. The detective did not think that there was any reason for an everyday person to keep chloroform, sulfuric acid, a canvas bag, and a butcher knife in the trunk of their car. He thought it was an abduction kit. Then, the investigators decided to go back and talk to witnesses. One of the first witnesses they talked to was the 15-year-old girl whom Horan had asked to help him turn off the water on the same night Lisbeth went missing. She said that when she was talking to Horan, she remembered seeing John Wilson run by them. This would suggest that Lisbeth would have come along very shortly after the girl walked away from Horan because she was following her brother. the investigators got help from an expert in forensic mapping. Based on the times and locations given to him, the expert thought that when John last saw Elizabeth, she was about 175 feet from where Horton was talking to the 15-year-old girl. If Elizabeth were walking and Horton remained in the same spot or close to it, they would have encountered each other in 13 to 17 seconds after John last saw her. That meant that John Horton was the only person in the area who could have committed the abduction. The investigators believe that Horton lured Elizabeth into the school where he sexually assaulted her and killed her. On August 7th, 2002, the investigators brought Horton in for an interview. The investigator with the KBI interrogated Horton. He confronted Horton and told him that he was the only one in the area who could have kidnapped Elizabeth. Horton maintained that he had nothing to do with the murder. He said he didn't even remember seeing Elizabeth that night. So the investigators continued to review the case file. In the file, they came across the name Joy Krieger. An agent with the KBI interviewed Krieger. Krieger explained that she was a former neighbor of John Horton. 2 months before Elizabeth went missing, Horton approached her and asked her if she wanted to get high. Krieger was 14 at the time. She assumed he was offering to smoke weed with her, so she agreed. They walked over to a nearby golf course. Once there, Horton pulled out a rag and a glass bottle. He poured some liquid on the rag and told her to take a deep breath. She sniffed it and said she wasn't going to inhale whatever it was. He then forced the rag to her mouth and her nose and she inhaled. Then she blacked out. When she woke up, she couldn't move. Her pants were down and Horton was fondling her. She passed back out again. She woke up again when Horton was pulling her pants back up. But then she blacked out again. When she awoke a third time, she instantly threw up. She was alone and decided to make her way home. Krieger was mortified by the experience, and she planned on never telling anyone about it, ever. After talking to Krieger, the cold case investigators thought that they had enough evidence to arrest John Horton. The district attorney agreed. On October 15, 2003, John Henry Horton was arrested and charged with murder. He went to trial in September 2004. The biggest problem for the district attorney was that there was no concrete evidence that connected Horton to the murder. The district attorney painted a picture as to what they thought happened. They think that Horton lured Elizabeth into the school and took her into a TV room. He had the chloroform ready. He also had the knife to make sure she felt threatened. Once she was in the room, he rendered her unconscious. Once she was out, he sexually assaulted her. They theorized Elizabeth inhaled too much chloroform, and that's what killed her. The star witness for the prosecution was Joy Krieger. The district attorney said that her experience was the blueprint for Elizabeth's assault. The trial lasted 6 days, and then the jury deliberated for 2 hours. 30 years after Elizabeth Wilson's murder, John Horton was found guilty of first-degree murder. In January 2005, Horton was sentenced to life in prison. But then, in February 2007, his conviction was overturned on an appeal. The appeal argued that the judge should not have allowed Joy Krieger to testify. The appeal argued that there was not enough evidence to show that her assault was similar enough to what happened to Elizabeth. The district attorney did not present any evidence that Elizabeth inhaled chloroform, that she was rendered unconscious by chloroform, or that she was sexually assaulted. The only similarity between Elizabeth and Krieger were their ages, and that is not enough evidence to meet the threshold of a prior bad act. The judges on the Kansas Supreme Court unanimously agreed, so they tossed out the conviction. John Horden went to trial again in January 2008. This time, Joy Krieger was not allowed to testify. At Horden's second trial, the district attorney had two new star witnesses. They were men who had served time in prison with John Horden. They both said that Horden told them he had accidentally killed Elizabeth with the chloroform while he was raping her. One of them said that he knocked her out with the chloroform, but she came to while he was raping her, and she started fighting him. So he put the cloth soaked with chloroform back over her air passages. But he kept it there too long, and Elizabeth ended up dying. He took her body to the field and dumped it. He planned on returning the next day to bury the body, but by that point, the police were already questioning him about her disappearance. The jury deliberated for 3 hours. Once again, they found Horden guilty of first-degree murder. He was once again sentenced to life in prison. In 1974, when Elizabeth was murdered, someone serving a life sentence in Kansas could apply for parole after serving 15 years. So John Horden was eligible to apply for parole in September 2018. He applied, but he was ultimately denied. Horden will be able to apply for parole again in November 2023 when he's 76 years old. At the time of this recording, 74-year-old John Horden is serving his sentence at the Hutchinson Correctional Facility in Hutchinson, Kansas. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. As always, our fact checker, sound designer, and producer was Anel Cloutier. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, follow us, or subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. If you just discovered this podcast, you should check out Criminally Listed on YouTube. We have nearly 300 videos featuring some unique and bizarre true crime stories. You can find Criminally Listed at youtube.com/criminallylisted. But that's all for this week. Take care of yourself, and please stay safe.